From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogay, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the election results and evaluate the candidates' performances with columnist Roger Simon. He's currently writing a book about the 1996 election and has covered every presidential campaign for the last 20 years. Also, a new memoir about raising a child with Down syndrome. Michael Barabe writes for The New Yorker and The Village Voice and is the father of 5-year-old Jamie. His new book is Life as We Know It. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a series of recordings by the Budapest Quartet made at the Library of Congress in the early 1950s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, this news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Administration officials say Secretary of State Warren Christopher plans to resign his office in the next few days, but he will reportedly stay in the post through President Clinton's inauguration next January. It is not clear who will succeed Christopher at State, but United Nations Ambassador Madeleine Albright and former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell are considered leading candidates. President Clinton will preside over a divided government again for the next 2 years. He won a landslide victory yesterday to gain a second term in the White House, while both houses of Congress remained in Republican hands. Speaking to supporters last night in Little Rock, the president looked ahead to the future.
Tonight we celebrate the miracle of America. Tomorrow we greet the dawn and begin our work anew. I am more grateful than I can say. You have given me an opportunity and a responsibility that comes to few people. I will do my best.
Meanwhile, Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole conceded with grace last night, telling his disappointed supporters that President Clinton was his opponent, not his enemy. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
An enormous hall filled with supporters chanted, "Thank you, Bob," as Bob Dole stoically accepted his defeat. With humor and dignity, Dole thanked his supporters, his opponent, and even the media for a great race, much to the dismay of some supporters in the crowd. But Dole was prepared for the moment, although after 35 years in Congress, he admits he may not be prepared for what comes next.
I was thinking on the way down the elevator, tomorrow will be the first time in my life I don't have anything to do.
Dole says he will sit back and watch for a few days and then, quote, stand up for what I think is right. First and foremost, however, Dole heads to Florida for some well-deserved rest and relaxation after a 96-hour campaign swing that may have helped more than one Republican House or Senate candidate in a close race. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
The CIA says it has not found any record of a link between itself and Nicaraguan drug dealers. The agency filed a legal declaration in federal court yesterday. There have been allegations that the CIA, with others, operated a cocaine ring in California during the 1980s and sent profits to a CIA-sponsored guerrilla army in Nicaragua. The accusation is being investigated by the CIA Inspector General. The San Jose Mercury News reported last August that a drug ring sold tons of cocaine to street gangs in Los Angeles and forwarded the profits to the Nicaraguan rebels. Several papers have questioned the Mercury News report. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up well over 48 points at 6,129. This is NPR. China has released ailing dissident Chen Zeming a few weeks before Secretary of State Christopher is to visit Beijing. Chen was accused of masterminding the pro-democracy protests in Tiananmen Square in 1989. He has cancer. He was released on medical parole and arrived home today. Christopher is to visit China later this month on a mission intended to improve U.S.-Sino relations. He is also expected to bring up the issue of human rights, a matter that has long irritated Chinese authorities. Technicians at Cape Canaveral are making final preparations to launch a rocket to Mars today. The mission will inaugurate a new era of Mars exploration. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
The Mars Global Surveyor is bolted atop an unmanned Delta II rocket as the final countdown to launch proceeds. The rocket will send the $150 million probe on a 300-day flight to Mars, which is the Earth's closest planetary neighbor. The probe will orbit Mars and photograph the whole planet numerous times over the course of a full Martian year. The satellite will also serve as a communications relay station for a Russian probe that will land on Mars next year and sample Martian rocks and soil. These projects are all part of a decade-long plan to learn a lot more about the planet in our solar system that's most like the Earth. A top priority is to look for signs of past or even present life on the red planet. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
U.S. heart specialist Dr. Michael DeBakey says Boris Yeltsin wouldn't have lived through his second term in office without heart surgery. DeBakey says the 65-year-old president's heart was functioning at about 20% of normal in September. Yeltsin underwent quintuple heart bypass surgery yesterday. DeBakey says the president's heart is now functioning more normally. Yeltsin reclaimed his powers of office this morning. The prime minister had taken care of them while Yeltsin was being operated on. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Fresh Air support comes from Morrow, publishers of the new autobiography Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. The last presidential election of the 20th century has ended with a historic second-term win for President Bill Clinton and the lowest voter turnout since the 1920s. For analysis, we tracked down journalist Roger Simon at his home this morning, where he's recovering from traveling with the campaign for the last 15 months. Roger Simon has reported on every presidential election since 1976. He's a nationally syndicated columnist and the author of the book Roadshow about the 88 presidential race. He's currently working on a book about how the presidential campaign has become more about performance than politics. Roger Simon says the final images of last night's election summed up the entire campaign.
The scene from Little Rock, a perfect visual. The president and the vice president, their families, walking out from between the gorgeous white pillars of the old state house in Little Rock, from a red carpet onto a blue carpet with fireworks in the background. And here in Washington, in a poorly lit hotel basement ballroom was Bob Dole and a crowd really of drunken kids. I was there that he sort of had to shush to be quiet so he could finish his emotional speech. I'm afraid that difference between the two campaigns and how things were planned and conducted continued from day one of the campaign to the last day.
How much of this campaign was based on performance? And I'm thinking of the introduction to your book, Roadshow, in which you say that what's alarming about the state of politics then and now is that our candidates give themselves over to the concept of continual performance until the person can no longer be distinguished from the persona, and that the public and the press, rather than decry this, seem to demand it.
I think you can't separate the candidate from the performance anymore. All we see is the performance. It used to be that reporters covering the roadshow, covering the event from the trail, got to occasionally see behind it. But every 4 years, reporters are pushed farther and farther away until, and I've spent the last 15 months almost constantly on the road, but in reality, although we don't like to admit it, the reporter on the road sees very little more than a person watching C-SPAN or a person listening to radio or just reading the newspapers regularly. And it's by design. The candidates don't want anyone getting a real look at what's going on. They want people seeing only their crafted performance. The difficulty for a candidate like Bob Dole versus a candidate like Bill Clinton is that Bill Clinton is a very deft performer. He has been speaking professionally to large groups since he was in high school. Bob Dole, on the other hand, is not a particularly good speaker, and TV is not especially kind to him. They seem to not have learned the lesson very well this time, that most Americans see a political campaign through the medium of television. And if you can't create a good television campaign, you're going to pay the price.
Do you think, though, that the performance of Bob Dole was
amplified by the failings of his campaign staff. And I got the impression that the staff didn't really have a handle on what communications means in this age, in the age of the internet, in the age of confessional talk shows, in the age of big event television. And the campaign seemed to have a rather strange relationship with the press as well.
Had a terrible relationship with the press. I can give you many examples. I'll give you a small one that's especially relevant to radio. I was on the Dole campaign just a few days before the end, and I was talking to Elizabeth Arnold, the terrific reporter for National Public Radio, who's covered Bob Dole forever from the beginning of the year on. And we were talking about when Bob Dole announced on the plane that he was going to do the 96-hour marathon, the day without end, and reporters rushed to their cell phones to phone it in. There was no radio reporter present, even though it was done in air on his campaign plane, and there was always a radio reporter, pooled reporter, as they say in the business, to attend all such events, to create a tape that could be used for all the radio stations in America. Why wasn't there a pool reporter allowed into this announcement? Well, the Dole campaign never cared about radio. And Bob Dole had announced something like 15 months ago. The Bob Dole campaign never understood an entire medium that serves millions of people. And she and other radio reporters were around me, and they gave examples. I think it was the CBS radio reporter said, you know, our morning drive time listenership is something like 2 million people. CNN's viewership is 400,000 people. Yet CNN gets interviews throughout the campaign and radio gets no interviews. I said, why? And he said, they don't understand radio. It's a foreign concept to them. They don't understand that we can react immediately. They don't understand that it's a medium of repetition which helps a campaign. They just don't get it. And I said, does the Clinton campaign get it? And he said, oh, yeah, they get it very well. Throughout the campaign, that kind of missing obvious aspects of modern communications that a high-powered, high-priced, well-funded campaign should get just continued from day one to the last day.
It seems as if the press is caught in a vicious circle. On one hand, you've written that the number of crews, radio and television and print, chasing the candidates around grows with every election. And at the same time, you note that the candidates are further and further removed from the press.
They are. It's a strange dichotomy. The number of TV stations, especially covering the presidential campaign, has exploded over the last few election cycles. Satellite time is relatively cheap. Many small stations or medium market stations in America want to send out their local anchor person or local star reporter to bring the news of the Iowa or New Hampshire primary back to the folks back home. And so they will show up at events and be traveling at events from event to event. The trouble is there's a limited amount of room, and a piece I did for Slate early on in the campaign was how there's just no longer physically any room for us.
You write about an incident in which a candidate came into a diner to schmooze with voters, and cameramen were literally knocking people's heads with the camera and going into the kitchen, causing unsterile conditions to catch a good bite.
It was a Martha's Restaurant in Nashua, New Hampshire, a traditional spot for candidates to go. But now, and it was Steve Forbes who was running. It used to be a candidate would show up with, oh, I don't know, maybe a dozen reporters, maybe 15. This included camera crews. Steve Forbes probably had over 200 media with him. There were people in the diner eating lunch. That was the whole point of the event. And you can't fit 200 extra people in there. Cameramen started jumping on top of tables, walking from table to table, tracking Steve Forbes with their lenses, dragging their wires across trays of cheeseburgers, bursting through the kitchen to run ahead of the candidate to get a better shot. It is simply an inescapable fact of physics that when a camera crew is walking in front of a camera candidate, shooting the candidate, that camera person has to walk backwards, not being able to see where he's going, and unfortunately, they often walk over people. It got violent. There were fist fights that broke out among the press corps. I saw so many people get knocked in the head with camera bodies and camera lenses that I soon lost count. I'm afraid it was the ugliest side of the press, and it occurred to me that the real problem with the American press is not whether we overemphasize this or concentrate too much on spin or don't emphasize issues enough and emphasize the horse race too much. The real problem of the American press is that we were hitting people with large pieces of metal, and I think that's what they objected to.
Roger Simon is my guest. He's a nationally syndicated columnist. He's covered every presidential election in the last 20 years. His book about the 1988 presidential campaign is Roadshow. He's currently working on a book about the 96 election. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're discussing election results with columnist Roger Simon. You described Bob Dole during his prep time for the second debate as a man who hates all the requisites of campaigning: rehearsal, repetition, and phoniness. What did you observe while you were traveling with the campaign that confirmed that idea?
The difference that the two candidates showed in preparing for the debates. I was with Bill Clinton in Chautauqua, this sort of intellectual camp in the woods of upstate New York, before the first debate. They couldn't get Clinton out of the rehearsal hall, his staff. He loved to be in there hour after hour rehearsing his answers. A very strange process that the American people accept, by the way, to show how we accept the performance aspect of campaigning. I think to a lot of people in other countries, it would be bizarre that these two men who have devoted their lifetime to public service and issues would have to rehearse answers written by other people so that during a debate they can regurgitate them for the American public to decide who is the most sincere. Anyway, that's what debates have become. Bob Dole, down in Florida at his condominium, just hated being in that rehearsal hall. He hated practicing. He hated memorizing. At one point, he took pages from his briefing book and in front of the press threw them off the balcony of his condo to show that he was done and would do it no more. If there is one rule of politics, and there are probably 51 rules of politics, it is that repetition counts more than anything else. As one political consultant put it to me, what he tells his clients is that when you are so sick of hearing yourself say the same thing that you literally want to throw up, it is then that it is just starting to reach the consciousness of the American people. Bob Dole is a guy who cannot stand repetition, the phoniness of performance, exactly what you need to become president of the United States.
That image of Bob Dole throwing those papers off the balcony makes him very endearing to me.
It's pure Bob Dole, and it's why I also wrote that although Bob Dole attacked the press, especially at the end of the campaign, in fact, reporters had a great deal of affection for Bob Dole, and always have. He was much admired by his Senate press corps and by the traveling press corps. They did admire the campaign, and they certainly did not admire his staff, but the candidate himself they liked. And I must say, at the end, Bob Dole came to the back of the plane, thanked his press corps. They applauded for him. He applauded for them. And it was a very warm and personal moment. And in his address last night, his concession speech, when the crowd began booing the press, Dole had to quiet them and shush them and say, you know, come on, come on, come on. Candidates sometimes don't know what forces they're unleashing. It was just like Bush in 1992 when he became when he began attacking the press in speech after speech, and the press and the crowds began to grow physically, you know, ugly toward the press. Bush had to jump in and rescue them. To the politician, they assume everyone knows it's not quite on the level, that the media is a convenient whipping boy, and they don't really mean it. I think they lose sight of the fact that there are a lot of people out there who believe that the candidates literally hate the media and respond in kind.
I guess you'd say the opposite was true of the press's relationship with President Clinton.
It's a much more complicated relationship. The Clinton campaign is much smoother with the press. The White House press operation is second to none in servicing the press, in dealing with the press, in providing information for the press. On the other hand, the Clintons, and I mean both the president and the first lady, I think on a personal, visceral level, do not like the press. I mean, the whole comeback kid phenomenon, to take us back to New Hampshire in 1992, was Bill Clinton coming back against what he considered the unfair treatment of the press. And I guarantee you right now, with all the press's concentration on questionable campaign financing procedures, Bill Clinton blames the press to a large extent for those stories and not to the actual procedures themselves. These are two people who do not like reporters, but do not let that personal dislike stand in the way of servicing the press and using the press to get their message across.
I appreciated a quote from one reporter from the New York Times who was covering the Clinton administration this election year, and he found that with Clinton's longest-serving aides, that in their most exhausting moments, they would admit that they wonder what he stands for besides winning, and that they assume the world will now finally find out.
Well, one hopes. I can see why they would be confused. As the president pointed out in his speech on election night and a few days before that, he has been running for office for an awfully long time. He has been running for office almost without interruption for the last 23 years. He's only 50 years old. That's nearly half his life. He has been seeking the approval of other people. That's a very personal thing. I think sometimes we miss how much of their own emotions candidates have invested in these races. When you lose, as Bob Dole lost, that's a very personal rejection. I can guarantee you Bob Dole didn't wake up this morning and say, you know, bad staff, bad planning, whatever, you know, could have done better, we'll forget about it. Bob Dole took it personally. Every candidate who runs for office and loses feels that the voters rejected him or her personally. And when you've devoted so much of your life, as Bill Clinton has, to seeking approval, I think you sometimes lose sight of what elections are all about. We're supposed to be elected, candidates are supposed to be elected to do certain things. It becomes easy, much easier, simply to constantly seek the approval of the public looking for the next election. Will Clinton now, since this is his last, was his last election, be liberated from that to do something, or will he find it simply impossible to break out of a lifelong need to to be really loved by the voters. If you ever saw Bill Clinton work a rope line after a speech, to me, a very direct physical representation of his need for approval from the crowd.
So are you looking
for a political leader?
Yeah, let's be politically correct. So are you looking forward to covering a Gore Kemp race in the year 2000?
Well, I'm not sure it's going to be. I'm sure it's going to be, well, as sure as I can be that Gore will run in the year 2000. He was already running last night with that rather too long introduction to Bill Clinton from Little Rock. I'm not sure Jack Kemp exactly covered himself in glory in this race. I'm sure it looked like a good deal to him at the time. But I don't think the Republicans I have talked to were very impressed with his debate performance against Al Gore. And I don't think that the activists in the party, and it's activists who control the primary process, thought that he really performed in the classic role of a vice presidential candidate. There was a strange reversal. Jack Kemp refused to fulfill the attack function. He told Bob Dole that going in, that he wasn't going to be an attack dog, in fairness to Jack Kemp. But that meant that Bob Dole had to be the attack dog. So it was almost as if Jack Kemp were running at the top of the ticket and Bob Dole were running as vice president. And that's one of the reasons, I think, that the Bob Dole campaign in its last 96 hours took a somewhat nasty tone. There was no one else out there to take that nasty tone. And I think some people in the party blame Jack Kemp for trying to be above it all to the detriment of the ticket.
Roger Salmon, I want to thank you so much for talking with us this early in the morning. Why don't you go get some sleep?
Thanks. My pleasure.
Roger Salmon's book about the 1988 presidential race is Roadshow. He's currently working on a new book about this election. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Michael Barabé says he's learned not to compare his son Jamie to other kids, even to other kids with Down syndrome. Coming up, we talk with Barabé about raising a child with Downs, the subject of his new memoir. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new series of recordings by the Budapest Quartet, made in the 1950s.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Jamie Barabe is 5 years old. He likes to listen to the Beatles album Abbey Road, climb on living room furniture, and eat hamburgers and french fries. He idolizes his older brother Nick. He's a lovable boy with a great sense of humor. The fact that he has an extra 21st chromosome isn't yet a part of his world. Jamie Barabe has Down syndrome. Jamie's father, Michael, says that that one little genetic abnormality places Jamie at the heart of nationwide debates about public policy towards the disabled, the ethics of genetic testing, the future of healthcare and social welfare, and, of course, abortion. Michael Barabe is a professor of English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. His new book about his son Jamie is Life as We Know It. He says he sometimes catches people staring at Jamie. I asked him what he imagines they're thinking.
The worst thing I've come across, really, is the sense from other parents that this is a tragedy, that we need either condescension or pity or some sort of distanced empathy in order to help us with this these travails. And especially when he was born, we got a few very kind but and well-meaning but sort of misaimed letters about about Jamie's birth. And I think that's about, if that's the worst we ever come across, that'll be fine with me. And we certainly don't run into things like fear or outright aversion from other parents. And part of the purpose of the book, part of the purpose, I think, of a number of the work of a number of parents with kids with disabilities, especially Down syndrome, is to make it clear to other parents or other children or people who have been children that this is not a tragedy. This is, this is part of what makes us human. It is very much like when people ask me what it's like having a child with Down syndrome, I say more than anything else, it's like having a child. He's a little more vulnerable to colds, to bad social policies. He has low muscle tone. He needs a little more work to do the kids do the things that other kids do. But otherwise, it's very much like having a child. And my hopes for him are pretty much the same hopes I have for Nicholas, all else being more or less unequal.
You and your wife chose not to have amniocentesis when your wife was pregnant with Jamie or any other genetic screening. And for practical reasons, the odds weren't really in your favor in her age group and all the other reasons people might choose not to have an amnio. Right. So you first discovered that Jamie had Downs at the birth. What were your initial reactions?
Well, my initial reactions were kind of weird. I don't think they're generalizable to any other parents, and that's partly because we had, in the middle of labor, a rather strange anomaly. A dangerous heart arrhythmia came up on Janet's heart monitor. Now, nobody in the room, including myself, would have known this. Janet, is, aside from being a PhD in English literature, she's also a former cardiac care nurse. So she looked over and she said, "That's VTAC." And I knew well enough, because I knew her at least 5-6 years while she was a part-time nurse at the University of Virginia Hospital. I know VTAC is possibly lethal. At the time, there was nobody else in the room except a staff nurse who didn't recognize it. And so we called a mess of people in. We were really on the ready, on the alert for a heart attack in the next hour or so. And then when Jamie was actually born, quite suddenly, his head presented almost out of nowhere. And when he emerged, he was purple and unmoving. And my first thought was that he was stillborn. So when he was diagnosed almost immediately with Down syndrome, my first reaction was that this was a reprieve. Janet was all right. This child was, he had Down syndrome, but he's alive. And this is a different order of thing than I had expected even a few minutes earlier. Now, it's taken me the remainder, 5 years and 2 months since then, to come to terms with some of the things that diagnosis means. One of the first things we did was just research Down syndrome and what it might mean for our child and whether we could handle a child with disabilities we didn't know about yet. But really, my first reaction was not, why me or how could this happen, but Down syndrome I can handle. And I think that was a little naive at first, but it was not most people's first reaction.
As you spent days, in fact, weeks with Jamie in the intensive care, you and your wife went through, I think, a series of reactions to accustom yourselves to the idea of having a child with Down syndrome. Maybe you could describe those.
Well, the first thing, one of the things that sort of was the impetus for the book and for a lot of what I have done since happened, I think, on the second or third day, Janet was still lying in. Jamie was still quite precarious. One out of 4 to 6 children with Downs are born with congenital heart defects, and so was he. It's a septal defect. It meant basically he wasn't oxygenating properly. He had to be put on 100% oxygen. And things were quite tense for quite a while, I'd say, you know, a couple of days. And then when I walked into the ICU one day, I saw that they had erased the phone number of the emergency helicopter service that would have to fly him up to Peoria, Illinois, for emergency heart surgery. So I knew that one was off the table. But we were talking quite some time about his heart defect, whether, in fact, it was going to cure itself without surgery, which it did. And we were also talking about the kinds of thing, you know, the prevalence of Down syndrome in the general population, something in one in anywhere from 600 to 1,000 live births, how much more prevalent it is when you realize that 4 out of 5 fetuses with Downs are spontaneously miscarried, da-da-da-da-da-da. And a nurse came into the room and took notes on our state of mind, and she left the notepad behind inadvertently, and we checked it out, and it said, you know, parents seem to be intellectualizing. I think she meant these people are not dealing with the reality in front of them. They're intellectualizing it away. Whereas for Janet and myself, you know, intellectualizing is our normal modus operandi. If we can't intellectualize us about something, we can't understand it. So part of coming to terms with who Jamie was and would be at that point really involved understanding something of the history of Down syndrome as well as, you know, what we could expect of his future. At the time, he was, you know, on 100% oxygen. We couldn't do all that much for him except look at him for the first couple of days. So I think intellectualizing was an okay thing to do.
You describe your first winter with Jamie as a thrash. What did that mean to you?
Well, that's a hard winter to revisit. It really was sort of backbreaking stress almost all the time. And I say this not to scare away people who have children with disabilities or who might. The major thing was simply that he was more susceptible to colds. And he had a lot of upper respiratory infections and ear infections. And the winters around here can be pretty brutal. Only in the 45th or so parallel, but whatever, it can get down to, you know, 10, 20 below, and with the wind chill, you know, much worse. And so we were trying to protect him as best we could. Knowing the history tended to help here. A lot of children with Downs in bygone decades would die before their 5th birthday simply for lack of what we now consider routine medical care. So we had on him, an apnea monitor, which was a strap around his chest that would, you know, beep if his breathing became too irregular. We had supplemental oxygen. So we had a nursery filled with, you know, oxygen canisters, which was kind of emotionally weird, but necessary. It was financially difficult because renting the apnea monitor, even though we were only paying a quarter of the fee for the apnea monitor, that was still $200 a month. The oxygen canisters were another thing. And for the first 2 months or so of his life, we were feeding him by nasal tube. We would insert a little tube into his nose, into his stomach, and feed him that way because he had such trouble coordinating sucking, swallowing, and breathing.
You both wore bells around your necks and would ring them when he smiled. I imagine creating a Pavlovian response to encourage him to be more responsive?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, the funny thing is that I had forgotten that. When my mother read over some of the manuscript of the book, she said, well, I certainly hope you're going to mention those bells. And it just shows you that repression sometimes really does its work. I said at one point in the book, there are some details of that autumn and winter I can't voluntarily recall, and that's one of them. So I think the thing with kids with Downs, especially in their early months, is that they respond to extra stimulus. They're sort of as much stimulation as a normal another child might require. It helps to up the ante slightly for a child with Downs, partly because of the low muscle tone. So that means, you know, we did a lot of massage therapy. We wore bells. We involved him in pretty much everything we could. You know, we made his nursery brighter and so forth. Again, it's not unlike having a child. It's just a little more. it's the same stuff we did for our first child, except that we did a little more of it.
I think the obsession of parenthood is the question whether my child is normal. For you, did that obsession turn itself into, is my child normal for a child who has Down syndrome? And how would you know what normal is?
That's a very, very good question. Well, for the first half of the question, we already had one abnormal child. Nick is a so-called gifted child. And so he's on one end of sardonically in the book, I say we have two kids at either end of the bell curve. When Jamie was born, we did have some concerns about Nick's development. I too, was a sort of either a gifted or a rushed child, depending on what the terminology is, you know, of this week. And I was tested for intelligence and aptitude and so forth from the age of 4, and I didn't want that to happen with Nick. I wanted Nick to develop at whatever his pace was going to be, and if he needed some help or stimulation or he was interested in something, we would run with it. With Jamie, of course, we're working on a radically different clock. I mean, I still have the same attitude. Whatever he's interested in, whatever he wants to learn at his pace is fine. But, of course, we weren't watching him over against the normal kid's developmental clock. And sometimes it's impossible not to do that. You see children younger than Jamie is doing things he can't do yet. And it will always, you know, bring something of a pang to our hearts. But at the same time, Jamie is always just Jamie. Whatever, you know, he's on his own, like I say, he's on his own clock, and that's fine with us. Now, as for other kids, what's normal for people with Down syndrome, that's absolutely impossible to calibrate for, I think, very good reasons. If you compare people with Down syndrome who are 30 or 35 today with what people with Down syndrome will be like when they're 30 or 35 30 years from now, there really won't be any comparison. You just can't, and this is something of a, it's a real historical divide between the people with Down syndrome who were brought up in the era of early intervention, when they, even as children, they got extra stimulation, and the people before, say, 1970 or 1975, who weren't. So what we're still finding out what normal is for people with Down syndrome. That's still very much under construction, and we don't know what to expect.
That must be the most difficult part of raising a child with a disability, then. How do you know when you're doing enough, when you're pushing enough? How do you know if you're helping the child realize their full potential and when you might be expecting too much?
Right. Well, that's we just boomerang back and forth between those two things. It's one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book, and one of the reasons I wanted to interrogate our understanding of what normal is at such length, because I think it's obvious enough. You can debate genetics and intelligence all you like, but people with Down syndrome, right up to the 1960s, a number of the features and traits of people with Down syndrome that had been attributed to Down syndrome would be better attributed to the policy of institutionalization. We simply did not know until really quite recently in the course of human history what the potential of people with Down syndrome could even be. It's not to say that the sky is the limit, but it is to say that even getting information 5 or 10 years out of date on this one doesn't give you an accurate picture of what can be achieved now and in the future. So on the one hand, you're always feeling that, you know, every waking moment should be some sort of learning lab. We've even hired a tutor to come in, you know, 3 times a week and work with him on computer things, since he's such a computer whiz. He's so good with a mouse. He understands computer games. He loves learning about them. And we thought, well, let's not let him have any more downtime watching Hard Day's Night again. You know, let's make this into a learning lab. And at the same time, you wonder, are you rushing your child? Are you doing a sort of a version of that obsession with developmental milestones that people have with gifted children? So it's a very complicated sort of matrix to run your aspirations for your children through.
Michael Barabay is my guest. He's a professor of English at the University of Illinois. His new book about his son, Jamie, who has Down syndrome, is called Life as We Know It. Michael, let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Barabay. He's written a new book called Life as We Know It, about the first 4 years of his son Jamie's life. Jamie has Down syndrome. Jamie qualified for early intervention services, and these are services provided in most states for children under the age of 3, and right. they are state administered. Programs like early intervention are struggling now for funding for a piece of the state pie. What has it meant to Jamie to have been provided those services, and what would have been the alternatives if they weren't there?
The alternatives, if they weren't there, was that he would have to hope to be born into a fairly wealthy family. Simple as that. The day you make, I mean, I feel this about healthcare, about early intervention, about a great number of things that have to do with our quality of life. The minute you make them contingent on people's ability to pay, you've pretty much sold out the promises of democracy. And no amount of anti-tax rhetoric is going to, on this day or any other, is going to make me feel otherwise. I know what those early intervention programs meant to Jamie. They meant that he was walking by two. It's as simple as that. And once he was walking, this sort of gets symbiotic. He needed a great deal of simply physical attention to his large muscle groups to get him up and sitting, then to get him to a stand, and then to walk. Because not only does he have the low muscle tone that all children with Down syndrome do, but he also, his mother, for whatever genetic reasons, is awfully loose-jointed. So he sort of had a double whammy when it came to doing things like getting up and ambulating. Once he was walking, though, once he was grabbing things, you know, in a pincer grip rather than palming them, which is a basic, you know, fine motor skill, all of a sudden he could walk around rooms and explore and learn for himself. And he, it also meant that he could go to daycare. Once he went to daycare, he started modeling his behavior on his non-disabled peers. And so you saw these just leaps and bounds in his development once the basic things were in place. I can't even imagine what the alternative to that would be. The alternative would be a regime in which Jamie meets the goes the path of least resistance, because if we wanted to let him be prone or take until the age of 4 or 5 to get up and walk, that would be fine with him. He really does need to be pushed on that on those fronts. But once he was walking, once he was once he had mastered a few fine motor skills, he was just a different child, and he was a different child in part because now he was eligible, in a physical sense, for daycare and inclusion with non-disabled kids.
Do people ask you if you knew before Jamie was born that he would have Down syndrome, or if it was an accident?
Yes, they do. Not too often. I mean, and certainly if I hadn't written about Jamie, people, I think, would be a lot more reticent about asking. But now that it's on the table, a lot of questions about our family decisions are fair game. We didn't know until he was born, and we had deliberately foregone amniocentesis because we didn't think that the odds were that great. The odds at the time, when Janet was 36, were 1 in 200 for having a child with Down syndrome. They were also about 1 in 200 for inducing miscarriage by way of an amniocentesis. And so we just thought that wasn't worth the risk, that, given the option between a possible miscarriage and a child with Down syndrome, we thought a child with Down syndrome seems infinitely preferable. Our decision to forego amniocentesis is not one that I would recommend across the board to people, regardless of their age or regardless of their personal feelings about abortion or disabilities or anything else.
I think your wife once was watching Jamie play and turned to you and said, "I just wish he'd stay the age that he is."
When Janet said that, Jamie had not yet turned one, and it was twinned for her with the thought that no one would come to his birthday parties. And I can report that she was quite wrong about that. Lots of people come to Jamie's birthday parties. It was also a worry that she had, and in the book I mentioned a similar passage in W.B. Du Bois's The Souls of Black Folk about the feeling of a parent wondering whether their child is going to grow up in a world of prejudice and hatred. Now, again, Jamie is going to have a good deal easier road to hoe than a black American child born in 1900. But nevertheless, the emotional tenor is very much the same. You wonder whether the world will always be a welcoming one for him. And again, parents can worry. You can worry about that for any kind of child. It isn't specific to a child with disabilities or a child with Down syndrome, but it is given, I think, in a somewhat it's rather more poignant it's along the lines, I think, of when we say that we hope Jamie learns everything he wants to learn. Well, you could say that about any child at all, but in Jamie's case, it's tinged with the sense that, well, we don't know what that will be yet. What the future holds for Jamie will probably have a greater impact on him because he will be less independent than most people than it would, say, for Nicholas or for a number of other children.
Michael Barabe, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you.
Michael Barabe's new book about his son Jamie is Life as We Know It. Barabe teaches English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that some of the greatest chamber music recordings ever made were by the Budapest String Quartet in the early 1950s, when they were the quartet in residence at the Library of Congress. Bridge Records has now made these extraordinary recordings available to the public.
Performing there on and off for 2 years, the Budapest String Quartet became quartet in residence at the Library of Congress, a position they kept for 22 years. Their concerts were special because they were allowed to perform on a unique set of Stradivari instruments that were not allowed off the premises. Bridge Records has recently acquired the rights to the library's archives, where the recordings of these live performances and others have been languishing for half a century. One of the works on the Budapest's official opening concert, August 3, 1940, was Haydn's Lark Quartet, and it's a high point on a disc that includes two other works by Haydn and Beethoven's Quartet for Piano and Strings. Here's the beginning of the radiant slow movement of the Lark. These performances of Haydn's Lark Quartet and his late Opus 76 No. 5, which was recorded in 1941, show the Budapest players at their best, refined but energetic, lean but full of rhythmic grace and the most delicate nuance of phrasing. The playing of Beethoven's Piano Quartet and the Hungarian Rondo from Haydn's G Major Trio, an encore piece, from a 1955 concert, is a little rougher, but they have the benefit of that master chamber pianist, the late Mstislav Horzhavsky. In the Brahms Piano Quintet and the Schubert Trout Quintet on a separate disc, the pianist is no less than George Sell, just around the time he was appointed conductor of the Cleveland Orchestra. how flexibly the quartet adapted to such diverse ivory tickling as the exquisite lyricism of Horshovsky and the classical restraint of Sell. In some ways, though, the most remarkable of these releases is the one from 1952 devoted to Rachmaninoff. This disc includes both of Rachmaninoff's rarely heard string quartets and the big Trio Elegique in D minor with pianist Arthur Balsam. Luscious, insinuating works that date from the 1890s and all composed before Rachmaninoff turned 23. The Budapest Quartet was founded in 1917 by four members of the Budapest National Opera Orchestra, three Hungarians and a Dutchman. By the time these recordings were made at the Library of Congress, the personnel had completely changed. In 1952, the players were Joseph Roisman and Jacques Gorodetsky, violins, Boris Kreut, viola, and Misha Schneider, cello. Not Hungarians at all, but four Russian Jews. They never made studio recordings of Rachmaninoff, so these forgotten gems of Russian Romanticism surely never had better performances.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a series of live recordings by the Budapest Quartet made at the Library of Congress on the Bridge label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Chris Fraley, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Morrow, publishers of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia, Savor the Joys of Baking with America's Best Bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.